Welcome to Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. On this podcast, we'll be discussing nonviolent readings of Latter-day Saint Scripture. I'm Dan, and I'm joined by my wife and co-host, Marianne.
The Latter-day Peace Studies Project is born out of a desire to proclaim peace by providing an opportunity to approach religion, Scripture, and relationships with God in a peaceful way. As we develop peace within ourselves first, we can reflect peace into the world around us. The Latter-day Peace Studies Presents Come Follow Me podcast seeks to assist listeners in their approach to Scripture by providing nonviolent interpretation. Our hope is that we can integrate the teachings of the Scriptures into our efforts to find peace within ourselves and proclaim peace in the world. Welcome back to Latter-day Peace Studies Presents Come Follow Me. I'm Marianne.
And I'm Dan.
This week, we are discussing Mosiah chapters 18 through 24. And in preparing for the block of chapters, the reading for this week, there is just so much that happens plot-wise in these chapters. And then on top of that, there is so much to digest sort of like doctrinally. And so we had to do a lot of cutting to try to keep this a manageable length, both for our editors and for our listeners. And so if it seems like we're skipping over a lot, that's because we are, because we just really don't have time to talk about all of the possible avenues and details that can be found in these chapters.
And in my personal study, you know, I'm going verse by verse, trying to really delve deeply. And so sometimes it's hard for me to let go of the, but I studied this verse and this verse has such a cool insight and, you know, such a cool connection or callback. And maybe, you know, if we had 4 hours an episode, we could get more of those sorts of things. But for right now, I think we must only stop occasionally to drink deep and not try to swallow the whole river. This week, the amount of stuff this covers, both doctrinally and historically, and then sort of thematically, there's a bunch of really cool little episodes. There's tons of callbacks to both Abinadi and Benjamin, and even back to Nephi. And so we really see Mormon's editorial hand coming in at certain points. Although I think that there's some evidence to say that he still hasn't really hit his stride, because he doesn't use his most famous phrase, "and thus we see," which later becomes sort of his editorial break-in, right? His voice, his narrative voice. We'll see him from time to time in these chapters. He'll break in, but not with a "thus we see," but still with an insight that might fit a "thus we see." But we start in chapter 18 with Alma fleeing, and this is sort of the chapter where Alma and his people establish their own congregation. Alma basically has a death penalty on his head, but is hiding out in the waters of Mormon and will come and teach the people. He starts establishing priests and teachers, large groups coming together, but being taught privately. I think it's interesting, verse 4, "And it came to pass that as many did believe him did go forth to a place which was called Mormon, having received its name from the king." Okay, does that mean King Noah named it? Or does that mean that there was a king named Mormon who this is named after? We get no insight or information, but it's in the border of the lands, which has been infested by times or seasons by wild beasts. So kind of convenient for them to be surrounded by wild beasts, because they're not going to get bothered by many people. In this land of Mormon, right, there's a fountain of pure water, and this is where Alma goes to reside. Near the water, there's a thicket of small trees where he could hide himself from the searches of the king. Well, this is also a map of Nephi's vision. We've got the fountain of living water. We've got the trees of life, place of protection. And then obviously people are gathering there. They're going along the, you know, straight and narrow path. They're flanked on every side by things that would destroy them. There's a great and spacious building just back in Nephi where Noah and his priests are mocking the faithful. So yeah, this is Nephi's vision all over again. And given that Nephi's vision has strong temple connotations, I think that we might argue that there are temple connotations here. Temples being associated with waters of life that flow from springs. Obviously, pure water is moving water. No matter what your theory for where the Book of Mormon takes place is, pure water is water that is moving, not stagnant, not still. So whether this is a river or some sort of natural fountain, it's moving water that we're going to see more rivers mentioned later. So this is one of the first ones, but he will go to another place of pure water in a little bit, but they are the waters of creation. They are seen as chaos in sort of mythology. They're the most chaotic. They have to be conquered, but they're also required for life. So there's a tension that's built in there. But that tension is where we get sort of, you know, the meeting of heaven and earth, the meeting of water and the shore. These are areas of contrast. So, but again, this is also another Exodus, one of the many that we've already seen in the Book of Mormon, and not by any means the last, but Alma has brought these people out, delivered them.
And then there are the famous verses that we read in connection with our baptismal covenants. Willing to mourn with those that mourn, comfort those that stand in need of comfort, and stand as witnesses. Oh, and bear one another's burdens. I'm sorry, I forgot to be in that one. Bear one another's burdens, mourn with those that mourn, comfort those that stand in need of comfort, and stand as witnesses of God. And I think it's really interesting if you think about these, not just as a list of four, but as a progressive building upon the last. So first, we have to bear our neighbor's or brother or sister in Christ's burdens. They are carrying something heavy. We don't let them be alone in that heavy thing. They are mourning. They are sad. They are grieving. And we grieve with them. We don't tell them to get over it or try to cheer them up. Yet, we have to mourn first. And then we can comfort. We try not to rush them with comfort too quickly because that's actually not comforting. Help them not be alone and then feel those feelings with them and then offer the comfort, because then that's a comfort that's actually meaningful because that person is with you in it. And then we can stand as a witness of God. And that's how we comfort, is by witnessing of God and sharing our testimony and truths. And so I see these as sort of progressive covenants that build upon each other there.
Yeah, I think especially the last two stanzas, the comfort those that stand in need of comfort and stand as witnesses of God. To me, the idea of comforting and witness reminds me of the Spirit, right? Those are two very obvious functions of the Holy Ghost. It's one of the things that Christ promises the apostles. He says, I will not leave you comfortless, but I will send you the Comforter, and I will come to you. So a witness is someone who has seen something, right, and can bear their witness about what they've seen. So the testimony of the Holy Spirit and the visitation by Christ, that's a pattern that exists, and this seems to be the capstone to these things. Yeah, I agree that it is a progressive thing, because coming into the fold, that's like the largest possible group. Like a sheep fold, right, covers quite a bit of ground, and to be called his people. So, you know, it's a branding, a way of marking yourself, a way of designating who you belong to, more than just happening to be in the right spot. You're also in the right, you're of the right people in that spot. And then bearing one another's burdens means that you have now started to contribute. You are working together with others. And then mourning means that you're not just physically contributing. You're not just both yoked to the same thing, but you're connecting at an emotional level. And then comforting, mourning, I don't want to say it's passive, but it's a less active version of comforting. You are mourning with those that mourn actually doesn't require you to do anything, whereas comforting requires active participation, and it requires another level of knowledge of what does this person need. Mourning, the only thing that you need to do is also be there. Comforting takes it to the next step of providing those sorts of things, and to stand as a witness of God in all times and all things and all places. So that is the ultimate, you've done all the things, and now you can stand as a witness of God, because now you're there with the shepherd. You are no longer just some sheep that happened to wander in the right place, got branded correctly, got put to work, and now is friends with the other sheep, and now is deep emotionally tied to the sheep. No, you are, you know the shepherd, and that is the ultimate point of all these things.
You are not just welcomed in, you belong there.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
And what is the result of that? The result of that is that you are baptized, which is wild, because it's like, well, if these are all the things that you want, well, here's how you enter. And why is that enter? Well, we know that baptism is the gate. So when Alma is talking about baptism, one of the things that's noticeably missing is the idea of baptism for remission of sins. This is a baptism as a witness of the covenant that they're making. And we'll see it equivocated with what King Benjamin has done with his people, entering them into a covenant. And similarly, King Benjamin wanted to give them a name. King Benjamin wanted to bring them into the fold, bring them to the temple, give them a name. He talks about how he works among the people, bearing one another's burdens, mourning and comforting. Well, King Benjamin's a little more, I think, on the nose when he is talking about his, you're less than the dust of the earth and those sorts of things and how, you need to be grateful. But I think that that is a way of comforting people because he's putting them in the right perspective of where they are. He's giving them an eternal perspective. And that is maybe one of the less obvious ways that we can become comforted, but still a comfort because the ultimate thing that the people do, they say, no, this is the desires of our hearts. Apply the atoning blood. We are witnessing right now what we want. And how are we witnessing? By having our names taken down, all those sorts of things. So there's strong, strong correlations and connections between these two events. And I think that's yes. Not a mistake. We've had King Benjamin and King Noah paralleled and contrasted, and now we've got King Benjamin and Alma being paralleled, and his people, and what their responses to this news is.
Here towards the end of the chapter, he talks about how the people of the church should impart of their substance, everyone according to that which he had. And we get some good details here about how they run the affairs of their society, right? Especially in contrast to the society that they just left, Noah's, that they should impart of their substance, of their own free will and good desires towards God, and to impart to one another. And then I just love in verse 30, this Mormon waxing poetic here, but saying, "Yea, the place of Mormon, the waters of Mormon, the forest of Mormon, how beautiful are they to the eyes of them who there came to the knowledge of their Redeemer. Yea, and how blessed are they, for they shall sing to his praise forever." And just the significance of place to us often when we, places where we have spiritual experiences or things that are special to us, just being in that place again evokes a special feeling. And then the phrase, "how beautiful are they," that's a definite intentional echo of Abinadi's discussion of Isaiah's passage, "how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of them that publish peace." And so what they're doing is publishing peace, and they're sharing the gospel and teaching the words of Christ. And that's what makes that place beautiful to those people.
This is one of those things that this group of people are going to be some of the least violent. Their constant response to violence is going to be either to run away or to not fight back. And we will see that again and again because the king finds out that there's something going on. He thinks that Alma's fomenting a rebellion, but that turns out to not be the case. Alma and his people, being aware, they take their tents and families and depart into the wilderness. So we've got another Exodus. We do hear that they managed to grow. I think they grow from like 200 something to 450 souls. So more than doubled before they leave. Then we take a little break from Alma and his people. We'll get back to them in chapter 23. But meanwhile, we need to go back to King Noah and his people. I think chapter 19 opens with an interesting little story. Just this little excerpt that there's something in here that I think there's three possible solutions, because verse 2, "And now behold, the forces of the kings were small, having been reduced, and there began to be a division among the remainder of the people." So this army of the king that he had sent to go chase Alma around comes back, and there are fewer people. Well, they don't get into conflict with Alma, so why are they reduced? Well, okay, number one that I think is maybe most likely is that some of them might have gone to join Alma and his people. Maybe some of the 200-odd converts came from this group that was sent to find them. I think that's most likely. But it's also possible that some just left, because we see pretty soon that there's going to be a split in terms of King Noah's supporters. And so maybe the writing is on the wall that his time is not long, and so these people just want to get out. It's possible that the waters of Mormon are in an area where we're told there's wild beasts from time to time. So potentially this group had a run-in with some wild beasts. Perhaps some of them died there. All possible. We don't hear what happens to that group exactly, so all speculation. But just one of those little narrative asides that I feel like is very interesting that I've never really thought about deeply before, but that just brings the richness of the Book of Mormon, that there are these little details and things that aren't necessarily answered, but that definitely color the world It's just another reminder that there are more people than are in the story that we don't see along the edges and fringes. But after that, we get back to this division, right, among the remainder of the people that is going to be between essentially the kingmen and the and Gideon's men. Gideon seems to maybe lead this group against Noah. He's an enemy to the king, drawing his sword and determining to slay the king, swearing in his wrath. You know, it's interesting because we will see a group of people who meet secretly and decide that they will swear to kill the king. They plot for essentially murder. But you maybe worth considering what Gideon's motivation here is. You know, is it primarily they've lived under Noah for so long and the economic pressures and pains and all that sort of stuff has just worn on them, and so they're just decide to, you know, overthrow the king? Well, maybe. Or it could be that Gideon is reacting to the treatment of Alma and his people, that the king is sending people out to kill some of the only righteous people. So hard to say. We will see Gideon again. He does chase down the king and nearly gets his wish of slaying the king, but king manages to point out that there's a Lamanite army coming by. Now, why is the Lamanite army coming by? Well, probably because there's been this small Nephite army roaming around looking for trouble. And I can only imagine that's why they're out. And we'll see later that the Lamanites really, really don't like the people who are in this Zeniff's colony, you know, Noah's at this point, but later Limhi. I mean, they just really hate those people. And I mean, we saw that with Zeniff, that they just kept coming back to fight them. It's just unfortunate that the Lamanites never managed to get along there for long, because this group of people had some peace during this time, and they had a decade of peace earlier, you know, more than 10 years of peace, but that was not to last.
I think this chapter and the next, we have some very intentional parallels between, or I guess contrasts, between how the Lamanites treat women and how the Nephites treat women. And so in
it's
verse
a parallel 10, on, you know, where the middle line is neutral action. So one right. is one is parallel to the, one is on the evil side and one is on the
right.
less not not
yeah,
side.
Parallel in that they never the two shall meet. But that in verses 10 and 11, that as the Lamanites are pursuing and overtaking them, that Noah says, men, save yourselves, like leave your wives and your children, right? And so that definitely reflects an attitude of women and children as property, as something that can be left behind. That's something that's not worth as much as your own life. And to their credit, many of these Nephite men, there were many that would not leave them, but had rather stay and perish with them. But there was at least a prevailing attitude in the society that their women and children were just extensions of themselves, that they were not to be seen as individuals. And the Nephites who stay with their families cause their daughters to go forth and plead with the Lamanites on behalf of their lives. And first of all, this is an incredibly courageous act, both by these young women and by their families, right? This is so trusting. But I think that they wouldn't have done it if they didn't have a reasonable expectation that the Lamanites would have compassion on women, that they would not indiscriminately slay women and children, that they were not that depraved. And so we see the Lamanites in this situation having more compassion on the Nephite women than a lot of the Nephite men leaders.
This is going to be, again, another point, because this might be a slight callback to the daughters of Ishmael who plead with Laman and Lemuel. So from the start, it appears that there's this thread of the Lamanites being sensitive to women, hearing the voices of women. So one of the things that the Nephites maybe fail to do is listening to the women. And that may be part of the reason that we have so few women's voices in the Book of Mormon, is from the Nephites not keeping up with that.
You had a really interesting insight as far as King Noah and his namesake from the Old Testament.
Well, yeah. So this Noah in the Old Testament, Noah, he is gathering people to preserve them and gathers the animals, but he's bringing things together to preserve them against the flood. But ultimately, what we see with King Noah is kind of the opposite, where he starts with a big group and then it just progressively gets smaller and smaller until he dies. But sort of the last holdout are going to be, Amulon and the other priests of King Noah. So that's going to be his last refuge. Now, the influence that Noah is going to have is still sort of outsized, because the fact is his actions caused so much headaches for Limhi and his people, and then Alma and his people. And it's just, again, we talk about the effect of a bad king later in Mosiah, and Noah is just the perfect example, because for the little that he contributes to society, he manages to cause a lot of pain and suffering. And especially if you just look at the women and children who are left fatherless, either through continued war, through them running away, it's just going to continue to cause problems. And just another point against having wicked kings. 18 and 19 is where we see that even the people who had fled with the king initially, Gideon goes out and finds them, and they decide to go back to the wives and children that they had abandoned.
Mm-hmm. Most of the people did not share Noah's view of women as property, yeah. But with him being the king, he definitely imposed that view on the rest of society.
Yeah, and this is the time where these are the people who, when they wanted to go back, King Noah said no, and so they burned him. That constant, even the people who fled with him, leaving their wives and children, still abandoned him at the end. So
yeah,
just another, there is no respite for the wicked. When you're surrounded by people who maybe have not made great choices, you can't exactly rely on them to make a good choice in terms of your fate.
Well, but evidence that Noah was not the only one to have those troubling views of women. Many of his priests also viewed women as property that they could take at their leisure, which many of them do. Those who ran away and left their families behind are out in the wilderness, and they observe some of the daughters of the Lamanites getting together out in the wilderness, out in a...
Shimlon.
In Shimlon, thank you.
Shimlon, which, by the way, one of the first places that Zenith Smith sent spies into, it's got to be some place that's, you know, kind of like a party site, a watering hole, right? Some place where information comes and goes if the spies are going to be there. And so it's possible that the women coming to Shimlon, it was clearly like a something that they went without their parents, right? This may be sort of a maybe they have a yearly tradition that they go do, you know, something in Shimlon. It's a almost a vacation destination or other, you know, ceremonial destination.
I can see that.
Ceremonial destination, perhaps. But it's a point of change and trade and, you know, exchange or something is going on in Shimlon that is different than other towns.
From a literary perspective, that setting seems to be of significance, for sure. When there are relatively few of them, so they wait for when there are only a few of them, and then they kidnap them and take them away in the wilderness. And the Lamanites are justly enraged with this, and they come against the people of Limhi. And all the people of Limhi know is that the Lamanites are coming to war against them again. That keeps happening to them, and so they prepare to defend themselves. And they defend themselves and drive the Lamanites off, but they at great cost. And the king of the Lamanites is among the dead, but just injured. He didn't actually die. And they get to have a conversation. And Limhi gets to ask him, like, what's up? Why did you do this? We haven't done anything. We haven't rebelled. We haven't broken that contract. And the king tells him about the young women being kidnapped and disappearing. And that's also, I think, it interesting to note. It numbers the young women at 24. So this society is willing to go to war. This is a huge civilization. They're willing to go to war because 24 of their young women disappeared.
Yeah, and I guess it's kind of interesting that they decide to go against the people of Limhi in response to this. And it makes you wonder, you know, was there some... Were some of the people recognized, right? Were some of these priests recognized and they knew where they came from? Was it just known that some Nephites did it? Hard to say, but the people of Limhi knew where Shimlon was and they participated in ceremonies. We got that the last chapter. One of the things that we didn't cover was that Gideon and his people performed a ceremony of some sort with the people who had gone with King Noah and then come back. And it says that without any commentary, so we have no idea what that means. But presumably the singing and dancing that these women are doing seems to be part of a ceremony, potentially. And then also the people of Nephi, you know, under King Noah, they had been known to strike the Lamanites retributively, and so to take more than they had. So Limhi's colony essentially had a big target on their back. I think Limhi might have a little bit of a self-esteem issue, because after the king tells him this thing, right, he says, okay, I'll search among my people. And Gideon's like, hey, hang on. Wait a second. There are barely any men left here, let alone men who could go kidnap a couple dozen women.
And then where would they be?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, you know, he has no, I guess he doesn't really have any evidence, but it's a pretty, you can see how he would draw that conclusion. And then, you know, he harkens back to Abinadi. Abinadi is going to be sort of a through line for all these people. And ultimately he says, well, let's keep the oath. Let's be in bondage and we can just stop shedding the blood. This is the part that doesn't make sense to me, because the king's pacified to the people. Limhi and his people had just won a big victory. This is where I say maybe Limhi had a little self-esteem issue, because he doesn't renegotiate any of these things. He doesn't say, oh, look, you broke your oath. Let's bump these taxes down. Or like, he doesn't do any of that. He says, no, we're going to continue the exact same way that things have gone. He doesn't try and reduce that taxation from 50%. It just continues. And I don't know exactly what's going on here. I suspect there's something else that I'm missing. But this is also the last time that this group will win a conflict. And it may just be that they had enough men die that they can no longer field any sort of real army. And so they're going to be in a bad situation. And it's possible that this is just... It's possible that this is all just the fulfillment of Abinadi's prophecy. That perhaps Limhi felt enough guilt. We see him feeling like he's not, he talks later about wanting to be baptized, but he doesn't have any authority. And so there's some like guilt and shame potentially. And the way that he talks about King Noah later, Noah, his father, he clearly sees a lot of this as the judgments of God. And some of it definitely is. But if I was him, I would have tried to get taxes down a little. But again, that's where I'm like, maybe I'm missing something.
So the Lamanite king promises that if they go out to meet his armies without arms, that his people won't slay them. And so Limhi's people trust him.
Yeah.
They do it. They go out without arms, which I think is incredible. And the Lamanites do have compassion on them, and they are pacified toward them, and they return to their own land. Now, this doesn't last, because then they are harassing the people of Limhi.
Yes, and we saw with Zenith. Zenith made these oaths, and the Lamanites would live up to them for 10, 12 years, and then they'd come attack them for a little bit. But it does make you wonder, given the Nephite propaganda about Lamanites being bloodthirsty and filled with, you know, eternal hatred. Is anyone giving a second thought to that in the Nephites, right? I mean, yes, they are still basically enslaved, 50% tax rate, but it just makes you wonder, like, what are the actual social dynamics? And is it possible that some of these Lamanites are still of the original people of Mosiah who fled, the Nephites who stayed back in Nephi, and maybe the Lamanites moved in and took over, so there's still some Nephites in here mixed in the Lamanites, and they're just called Lamanites because they're no longer with the people of Nephi? There's a lot of subtle texture to some of these interactions that, taking just a surface level read, you may not consider that. We get them dwelling in the land in peace for a little bit.
Yeah.
Many days.
Yeah, many days. Yeah, and then they start harassing them, and they're not allowed to kill them, but they certainly make their lives very miserable. And there was no way that they could deliver themselves out of their hands, but they still think that the solution to this is violence. And three times in a row, they try to fight for their freedom and are brutally cut back and slaughtered. And I mean, this is just heartrending. And it says, I mean, it covers this in just a few verses, but just how awful this must have been, that all of these men are dying in these wars, trying to free their people, right? If there's ever a just war, you would think that this would be it, and that the Lord would bless them. And they don't have Noah as their king anymore. They have Limhi. Limhi's a good guy, but they just can't win. And their proposed solution of violence here is not working out. So in verse 13, after the third time of trying and failing, they finally accept that they have to humble themselves, subjecting themselves to the yoke of bondage, submitting themselves to be smitten and to be driven to and fro. Which is what Abinadi said of Jesus, having to be humble and submissive, and that submitting without yielding, suffering without yielding. And they have to hold this tension for a little while longer.
Obviously, this is going to be compared and contrasted with the people of Alma, who later are brought under their own subjection. and their own subjection to the priests of Noah, not just the Lamanites. It's a double level of subjection. I think it's the ultimate, you get to choose your suffering. Do you choose to try and take care of it yourself, or do you choose to trust in the Lord? And so the parallels and contrasts between the people who try and deliver themselves and have to be beaten back three times to get just the message. And verse 15 is a hard verse. The Lord was slow to hear their cry because of their iniquities. This is one of those times where it's like, well, is that really the character of the Lord? Because we have Christ teaching through the prodigal son that the father, when his son was a far way off, ran to meet him. I think he's still that father in here. And so it makes you wonder, how much of this is their perception of the Lord being slow to hear their cries, right? Is the Lord slow to hear their cries because of their iniquities? And by the way, those iniquities were all the times that they went to battle. And so that's why he was slow, because they didn't bother getting the cries out until after they had tried the every other way.
Trusted in their own strength first. Yeah.
He does soften the hearts of the Lamanites, but not yet delivering them from bondage, which is actually basically directly paralleled by Alma's group, who they don't actually get any cessation of the workload, but they are made stronger. Again, this colony, this group, they begin to prosper by degrees. This is the third or fourth time that this has happened, where they've managed to get some peace and actual prosperity and growth. And of course, at other times in the Book of Mormon, we're looking for the pride cycle, but one of the things that we got to look here for is the jealousy of the Lamanites and the oppression that they bring. And Limhi constantly tries to bring these people together as much as possible, right? To bring them into one body. Even though they're growing and prospering, there's still a great number of women, right? More than men. So in order to protect and keep everyone safe, he has to keep them as close as possible. This is verse 19. The king did not trust his person without the walls of the city, unless he took his guards with him, fearing that by some means he might fall into the hands of the Lamanites. This is why he reacted the way he did to Ammon. This is where we finally get that explanation for why he was so jumpy and immediately threw them into prison.
Yes, and then in verse 23, it's because they thought they could be some of the priests of Noah that had kidnapped some of those young women and brought all of those terrible things upon them. And had they been the priests of Noah, he says that he would have caused that they should be put to death. So, like, they were they knew what they were going to do if they found those guys, but they didn't. Which makes me wonder if Limhi knew them. He must have known them personally. So how did he not recognize that those men weren't among his father's priests? I don't know. That one's kind of a question for me.
Well, it was at night, right?
Oh, I've never thought about that. I don't know that it says.
For some reason, I had it in my head as night. That may just be my imagination. But I don't know. Possible. It's possible it's just someone they didn't recognize, right? Who weren't obviously Lamanites. So they're like, oh, this is another group of Nephites. What if there's some of those priests? Hard to say. And again, just evidence that the priests of Noah have caused quite a little issue for this group, right? Although, in verse 21, where it talks about, okay, these priests of Noah, they had come into the land of Nephi by night and carried off their grain and many other precious things. Therefore, they laid wait for them. How do they know that it was the priests of Noah, right? Because this is it's a relatively small group. And also, there are Lamanites there who, from time to time, you know, come and harass them. And Lamanites, throughout the Book of Mormon, will scatter flocks and herds.
It's true. So,
for me, I would have guessed Lamanites, but they might have some evidence against the priests of Noah.
They might have some reason to believe. But, well, and then we get the people of Limhi. Once Ammon from the city of Zarahemla comes, they find, you know, the people of Limhi, and they've had a change of heart, and they want to be baptized. But no one in the land at least claims to have authority from God. And it says Ammon declined doing this thing, considering himself an unworthy servant. So did he not have the priesthood, or did he not feel himself worthy of exercising the priesthood? Or Ammon doesn't seem to be someone who's lacking in confidence or self-assurance in all of his other actions. So I find that really interesting.
Yeah, and it also raises the question of, well, Alma felt fine baptizing, and he was one of the wicked priests at some point.
Yeah.
And so did Alma receive another? I've read theories that Alma received another priesthood from an angel. I don't know if I buy that theory, but again, maybe it ties back into, well, what's the purpose of the baptism? Alma's not baptizing for remission of sins, which is one of those things that I think you might be able to go in the Doctrine and Covenants and say, oh, you know, the Aaronic priesthood is baptism for remission of sins. And so if you're just baptizing as witnessing the covenant, maybe there's a little bit more flexibility there. I don't know. This is where I'm like, I'm on very shaky ground out on a limb here where I'm like,
Alma
I don't know.
Does say in that chapter, in chapter 18, Alma does say that having authority from God.
It's true.
He does claim to have authority.
It's true.
And so anyway, that's just a really interesting, they wanted to be baptized as a witness and a testimony that they were willing to serve God with all their hearts.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, they did prolong the time. So that had happened, that conversion had happened in their hearts, but they still wanted to be baptized as a witness of that, of their conversion. But the conversion had happened.
Yes. And okay, verse 31, they did mourn for their departure, for they knew not whither they had fled. Now they would have gladly joined with them, for they themselves had entered into a covenant with God to serve him and keep his commandments. So I think this is an example of Mormon inserting his voice to equate the baptism of the people of Alma with the covenant that Benjamin puts his people under. And that Limhi is now like, well, we also entered into a covenant and we want to be baptized. Well, first off, where's Limhi getting this idea from? Because again, Alma seems to spontaneously generate baptism because he has no access to the small plates, which is where Nephi talks about it. So where is this coming from? What is this desire? I suspect that there's something going on in the land of Nephi that might have some other cultural memory of baptism, and that either Limhi heard about what Alma did and was like, oh, we need that too. Maybe Alma's the first one to put all this together. And that's why, because even later, Alma, I think it's, I can't remember if it's Alma 1 or Alma 2, who, when he's the head of the church, he's still the one baptizing people. People come to him to be baptized. And so again, there's something going on that's a little bit deeper in terms of what they're using and looking at baptism for, and the notion of covenant, and the fact that they don't even form themselves into a church. They're just going to wait. They want to be baptized as witness and testimony, but they did prolong the time. And here we go, where Mormon jumps in, and an account of their baptism shall be given hereafter. This is where I think in Mormon, composed in stages, learned, got better. Later on in the Book of Mormon, if he was redoing this, I'm sure he would say, and thus we see those who are desirous to witness to God as a testimony to serve God with all their hearts, they desire to be baptized. Something like that.
Yeah.
So this is where he's like, and we'll give that account later. But it is a glimpse into the compilation of these plates, because as he's weaving this story, which we've already seen that we've left alone the kings, you know, the priests of Noah, we've left alone the people of Alma, we've left alone Ammon all the way back there, and now we're bringing him back, right, with Limhi. And so he clearly had in mind this composition. And he knows he's going to come back and touch on this. He knows he's got some threads that he needs to bring back together. I think that's really just an impressive show of Mormon's hand. Because verse 36, and now all the study of Ammon and his people and King Limhi's people was to deliver themselves out of the hand of the Lamanites and from bondage. This is back to real time. We are back to the present in the Book of Mormon. Everything before this, back when we saw Ammon, all of this has been a flashback, essentially.
Right. And we're going to get another one in the next two chapters.
Yes.
But this one's going to kind of tie up this end, and then we're going to tie up another end, and then we'll bring it all together.
Yes. So chapter 22, verse 1, another king calls a gathering moment, right?
Yeah.
It's just, we constantly see the king gathering the people. Presumably this is to the temple, which is still there, or maybe repurposed Noah's court, or maybe those are the same thing.
Yeah.
Hard to say, but they ultimately come to decide that the only answer is to flee.
And Gideon is the one who comes up with the idea for that, right? He formulates a plan where he thinks it's going to work best. They're going to get the Lamanites drunk, extra drunk. They're going to gather all the people together so they're ready. And when the Lamanites are so drunk they can't, they're basically incapacitated, the people will leave in the middle of the night and be gone by morning. They have to flee in the middle of the night. So this plan is cooked up by Gideon. And they have to use some deceit, and they flee at night. And I think it's also important to note that they took their records with them because Mosiah receives them and their records and also the records of the Jaredites that they found. And so that's something, you know, they flee with their records, right? That's another part of the pattern. And then this does directly, I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but again, we have some more parallel stories here of Alma's people getting out of their situation, escaping by the Lord's plan. The Lord is the one who comes to Alma and not comes to him, but tells Alma, here's the plan, here's what you're going to do. So it's the Lord's plan. And he causes a deep sleep to come upon the Lamanites. And so there's a miracle there, and it's not by deceit that Limhi's people have to resort to. And they get to leave in the morning, in daylight. They depart in daylight instead of under cover of night. And so just those interesting parallels to contrast those two groups and how they had to use different means available to them because of their different resources. So
ultimately, God still is responsible for the delivery of both. But one seems to require a lot more work on their part. Verse 7, when he's hatching this plan, it's funny because this is kind of the one good thing that Noah did, right? When he became this wine bibber by planting all these vineyards, even though it was bad for Noah himself, it wound up being turned by the Lord to a blessing. And also not the last time we will see the Nephites use wine in order to perform some trickeration, as one particular president might describe it. But they are received by Mosiah with joy. They get back to Zarahemla and become his subjects. So this group, it's like, it's a very roundabout way to say, oh, we probably should not have gone back.
Exactly. This was a mistake.
Yeah.
We have one more little chunk. Here we come. Chapters 23 and 24, which is an account of Alma and the people of the Lord who were driven into the wilderness by the people of King Noah. And so just this last little chunk.
Yeah. One more note, though, is at the end of the chapter 22, we get these Lamanites pursuing the people of Limhi, but they lose them after 2 days and they get lost in the wilderness. But we will hear back from them again, right? Uh-huh. They're going to show up again.
That's right.
So
that weaves back together eventually too. So now we get an account of Alma's people after they flee, their 450 people or whatever, they flee from King Noah's armies and flee out into the wilderness. And it's a land of pure water, which seems to be very important to Alma, and they pitch their tents and till the ground and build buildings, and they start their own little city.
This is the promise, right? If you follow the commandments, you'll be blessed and prospered. If you don't, you'll be harassed by the Lamanites until you are. Alma gives a speech about why he doesn't want to be the king and why kings are not great. But it's funny because all this speech does prove is that he would actually be a great king. He is the head of the church. It's Alma. Yeah. Alma too, who becomes a chief judge later.
And we'll get
then
there.
Steps down. And there's a whole the whole process.
We definitely get an insight here into Alma's change of heart, right? We didn't learn a lot about him before he heard King Noah before he heard Abinadi. And he was a young man when he was a priest of King Noah. It does say that. But we get a sense of who he might have been as a young man because of what we know about King Noah and the other priests and his court. And then we get his discourse here about the nature of the soul and the worth of a soul and how we should run our society. Verses 14 and 15, trust no one to be your teacher nor your minister, except he be a man of God, walking in his ways and keeping his commandments. Thus did Alma teach his people that every man should love his neighbor as himself, that there should be no contention among them. So again, high contrast to the way that Noah ran his civilization. So they were really starting a different project here. The description of Alma and his people really reminds me of a lot of the descriptions of the early Christians, and especially like that first century when Paul's writing letters and how this is new for all of them. They are all beginning fresh and they don't really have models for how this is supposed to work except for the words of Jesus or the words of the prophet. And so they're just doing their best. We don't know a lot, but we know this much. And so they put everything into those things that they do know. Every man love his neighbor as himself and no contention among them. And that seems like a really great starting place.
It's interesting to me, again, we have him consecrating priests and teachers, right? Consecrating, not ordaining. Just an interesting little note. Consecrating, not anointing, because they don't have olive oil. But this idea that he's all the priests and teachers, he doesn't talk anymore about baptism here. That baptism event seemed like kind for this group, it seemed like kind of a one-off thing. So interesting little note here, but the watching over the people, nourishing them with things pertaining to righteousness. This is a little bit of a contrast to the other times, at least in Zarahemla, where it's like the people were righteous, but only because they constantly were being stirred up into remembrance. And it's interesting that this group is one of the more peaceful groups in the Book of Mormon. We do get a little ominous insight in this chapter with Mormon spoiling some future events, where after they multiply and prosper exceedingly, we get, "Nevertheless, the Lord seeth fit to chasten his people. Nevertheless, whosoever putteth the trust in him shall be lifted up at the last day. Yea, and thus it was with this people. For behold, I will show you that they were brought into bondage." So, well, there you go.
There's his early, "For thus we see," yep, "and thus we see."
"Nevertheless, I will show you. I will show you, and thus we see," are basically the same phrase, just kind of switched around. So, you know, with the ultimate message that he did deliver them, did show forth his mighty power. And you mentioned a little bit about that. But, of course, the next thing that happens is an army of the Lamanites was in the borders of the land. And that's where we had the armies of the Lamanites that got lost after a couple days.
After chasing Limhi's people.
After chasing Limhi's people. And it makes you wonder, okay, so they're in the land of Helam, this place in Helam. Army of the Lamanites comes. Who does Alma and his brethren think that this is? It's been years since they had contact with the people of Limhi. They presumably had not had much Lamanite contact, so could they have thought at first that this was the armies of King Noah? They don't know what happened to Noah. It's got to be a blast from a past, just very foreboding what happens here, running into this group. But Alma comes out and he says, "No, let's not be scared, because God will deliver us." And so they hushed their fears and cried to the Lord that he had softened the hearts of the Lamanites, that he would spare them. The Lamanites, though, as we saw with the people of Limhi, they were fine sparing people.
There's no account of the people trying to even defend themselves. They don't run to grab their swords. They don't try to form their army. They gather to Alma and they're afraid. But Alma says, "Trust the Lord." He doesn't say, "Go get your sword." He says, "Trust. We've been doing what we need to be doing. We've made a covenant with the Lord and we can trust him." And so they do. And it doesn't mean things go very nicely for them, but they're not slaughtered. And they delivered themselves up into the hands of the Lamanites and they take possession over the land of Helam. And the Lamanites actually aren't that terrible to them. I mean, they take possession of their land, right? Yeah. You could say they colonize them or something like that. But the problem is that they then put one of the priests of King Noah named Amulon in charge. And Amulon, because he apparently took to wife one of those 24 young women that they kidnapped, the Lamanites, knowing that the fate of their daughters rest in the hands of these men, have to show some leniency with them. They have to try to make their daughters' lives better by making their daughters' husbands' lives better. And so they put Amulon in charge of this group where Alma and his people live. And they get a little bit of authority. Just the sad nature of nearly all men, that as soon as they get a little authority, they will exercise unrighteous dominion. And Amulon is just so happy to be in charge of something again. And he rushes directly to making all of these sweet, patient, Christ-like people's lives as miserable as he can.
Now, I think technically you could read this as there's one group of Lamanites who initially oppresses Alma and his people, and then you get another group who are these lost Lamanites. But I think that's more of an explanation of which the first group was. Hard to say, but either way, they do trick Alma because they say, just show us where Nephi is, where the land of Nephi is. And then they do not keep that promise. They set the guards round about. But then you do have them go to the land of Nephi. So a part of them return to go to the land of Nephi. But a part of them come back to the land of Helam and bring with them the wives and children of the guards who had been left in the land.
Yeah, so they come in and settle.
Yeah, so there's still this notion of, oh, this place is pretty great, even if we're occupying it.
Well, perhaps also isolated. They're not going to go back and forth. The guards aren't going to go back and forth. Like, them being set as guards here, they're pretty much settling. They're being transferred there, if you want to think about it in a military term.
It's pretty clear that the king of the Lamanites, so he gives Amulon to be king. The only reason he's doing that is not because he likes Amulon, but probably because Amulon's married to a Lamanite woman. And so he's like, we keep some Lamanite power here.
For him to have as much power and influence as he does, he was likely, this is an assumption, but I think it's a fair one, he was likely a very charismatic and flattering.
He did gain favor in the eyes of the king of Lamanites. This was 24-1.
That's right. He knows how to schmooze them. He knows what he's doing to try to get people to do what he wants to do. He's a great manipulator.
Verse 3, I think, is interesting. The name of the king of the Lamanites was Laman. So they are keeping up this pattern of naming the kings after the first leader. That's not going to be true, obviously, by the time that we get through Alma. Like, we see some interactions with Lamanite kings who are not named Laman. At some point, they also break that tradition, just as the Nephites did. Interesting little note here. So he was called King Laman. He was king over numerous people. And he appointed teachers of the brethren of Amulon in every land, which was possessed by his people. So Amulon, apparently, we don't often speak of Amulon as an antichrist, because he's not quite in the same category as Nehor and Cherem and
Korihor
or Amlici. But Amulon has a pretty negative influence, but this idea that they're teaching the language of Nephi to the Lamanites. Well, okay, they're still speaking the same language at this point.
Well, they were able to communicate. Zenith is able to communicate with the king. Like,
yeah,
they're having interactions. It's mutually intelligible. However, even though it's been hundreds of years, they still speak enough to communicate, right?
It makes you wonder if this is more of a cultural language.
I'm thinking it might be more literacy, the written.
Yes. Well, I mean, that's part of it, probably. Because the Lamanites start to keep records, which is interesting because that's kind of one of the big things that the Lamanites do keep a record, but it's not a written record, and it's just a record that's wrong. It's that we were wronged by Nephi way back when, so.
There's an increase in trade and education and record keeping, and I think this is kind of a real flowering of culture for them, for the Lamanites. And it comes through this greater education, but it doesn't come with the sharing of the gospel. It's secular. It's divorced from the origins of that learning.
It makes me wonder if Amulon was maybe one of the great minds behind Noah, because Noah was apparently prosperous enough to go build a bunch of buildings and towers and expand the people, yeah, right? And run great armies. And so maybe Amulon had sort of a knack for that type of thing. And so this is where
he's administration.
He's able to industrialize the Lamanites here so that they see this great success. But of course, once he's in this position of power, he begins to exercise authority over Alma and his brethren. Just a reminder that the cruelest punishment doesn't come from the Lamanites. It comes from other Nephites. And we'll see infighting in the church later. That just is a little reminder that some of the worst persecutions are not coming from outside, but from inter-congregational conflicts. The situation was tolerable when it was the Lamanites, but when Amulon had his way, he was cruel enough that in verse 10, they are turned to cry mightily to God. But Amulon commands them to stop, sets guards over them. So Alma and his people keep the prayer always in their hearts, and they are comforted. They mourn and are comforted.
I love in verse 13, the voice of the Lord came to them in their affliction, saying, "Lift up your heads and be of good comfort, for I know of the covenant which ye have made unto me, and I will covenant with my people and deliver them out of bondage." And that is the covenant that the Lord made with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses.
The one that they just made at the waters of Mormon, right?
Exactly. Well, that's what I'm saying is that it's the same covenant down through the ages, and the Lord continually reminding us that he will keep that covenant.
So they are comforted, right? Verse 16, be of good comfort. On the morrow, I will deliver you out of bondage. You know, he tells Alma to tell everyone. And so all the people gather their flocks together, their grain. All the night, they gather these things together. And then the next day, the Lamanites are deep asleep.
I also love, I've noticed this a few years ago when I was reading this, and I've thought about it every time I've read it since, that in verse 14, when the Lord says he's going to ease the burdens while you are in bondage, and then he tells the people why he's going to do this. The Lord doesn't often tell us why. That's usually something he reserves for himself. But he says, "And this will I do, that ye may stand as witnesses for me hereafter." So recalling their covenants at the waters of baptism, "Stand as witnesses for me hereafter, and that ye may know of a surety that I, the Lord God, do visit my people in their afflictions." And so he says, this is what you're going to see, and this is why I'm doing it, so that you know that it's me, and that you can always be a witness that the Lord is with you in your afflictions. And I find that really powerful.
They now depart into the wilderness. This is Exodus number 6, 7, I don't know. But they travel, get to a valley that they call Alma, and their response to pour out their thanks to God after having been delivered. They stop and spend time giving gratitude, which is a dangerous thing because they know that well, the Lamanites could come after us at any point.
They're still being pursued.
They're still being pursued. And honestly, based off travel times that come later, I think a little bit later, it seems like you can get from Zarahemla to Nephi in like 2 weeks. So they were not that far apart.
Yeah.
So if they just travel for a day, all this group with flocks and herds and grain and women and children, they can't move as fast as an army of men. So this is a risk that they're taking, but I think it's absolutely reasonable for them to take, given that they trust the Lord and the Lord delivered them. And I think they also know that the Lord's not going to deliver them only for the Lamanites to come right back and bring them back to bondage.
Right. But the Lord does say.
But the Lord does say, all right.
Good. Now get out of here.
But he promises to stop the Lamanites so that they won't come in pursuit of those people. But they arrive in Zarahemla, and King Mosiah did also receive them with joy. Now, Zarahemla now has the people of Mulek's descent, Mosiah and his people, Limhi, Ammon, Alma and his people. So all this scattering that we've seen is now brought back together in Zarahemla.
We're all together again.
The next time not the next time we leave Zarahemla, but there will be a next time that we see people leave Zarahemla, and it's not the greatest reasons.
Yeah.
Sadly, we will see some amazing spiritual growth, and we will see some amazing spiritual decay, and it's just going to be a continual roller coaster. Both finishing Mosiah, although Mosiah ends on, we get some good chapters of optimism, and then we get a lot of unfortunate chapters, but there's so much in here, and this is a part of the Book of Mormon that I've always sort of skimmed by, this ending of Mosiah, because it's like, well, let's just get to Alma. That's where I want that story to pick back up. But without understanding all of this, I think that we might miss some context for what become the eventual missions of the sons of Mosiah and Alma the younger to the Lamanites. So all of the mission stories that we get are going to be enhanced if we think back to, well, what were the Lamanites doing? You know, what was the relationship of the Lamanites and the Nephites just prior to this? And thinking, oh, that might be why this king is not thrilled to see Nephites. And this, oh, the Lamanites scattering flocks and herds. That's something we've seen before. And
yeah.
There's a lot in these chapters. And again,
we'll get there.
Yes, I know. we still managed to keep this time pretty in check, I feel like, for the amount of material that we have. But
it was a lot of material. I felt like we just really skimmed the surface, but hopefully that was helpful and gave you some things to think about and ponder and talk about in your conversations and your families and your Sunday school classes, and that you feel that we bring a unique voice to the curriculum of Come Follow Me. So I think that's all for this week. We'd like to, as always, thank our editors for all the hard work that they put in. Please review this podcast on your podcast platform so more people can find it, and subscribe and tell other people about it so they can join in on our discussions.
If you'd like to get involved in the Latter-day Peace Studies project, you can join the Facebook group Latter-day Nonviolence, Pacifism, and Peace Studies. We've got some links in the show notes. Make sure to check our website out and the Get Involved page to see how you can contribute regularly to cover the cost of hosting. For Latter-day Peace Studies, I'm Dan.
And I'm Marianne.
See you next week.